Welcome to Masters of the Stage. This SDC Foundation program illuminates the creative processes, secret mottos, and personal and professional experiences that guide today's luminary directors and choreographers as they forge artistic careers in a profession that has no handbook. These intimate and dynamic conversations between today's most successful artists offer audiences rare insights into the challenging and ever-changing world of theater making. I'm David Roberts. I am the Foundation Director for SDC Foundation, and I'm so pleased today to have David Caporeliotis and Sam Gold, and I'm going to share just a bit about them shortly. Their brief bios. So, Sam Gold is a
Tony winner.
Tony award winner. Sam Gold. His Broadway credits include A Doll's House Part 2, for which he got the Tony nomination, Fun Home, the Tony Award, The Glass Menagerie, The Real Thing, The Realistic Joneses, Picnic, and Seminar. And his other recent credits include Hamlet at the Public, Othello at New York Theatre Workshop, John at Signature, Uncle Vanya, The Flick, The Big Meal, Look Back in Anger, The Aliens, Circle Mirror Transformation, and he did his training at Juilliard. And David Caporeliotis is our casting director who opened Caporeliotis Casting, formerly MelCap, in 2007 after 11 years on staff with Manhattan Theatre Club. He is a board member of the Casting Society of America and serves on their diversity and inclusion committees. He's been nominated for several Artios Awards for casting on Broadway, off-Broadway, and in regional productions. And he has many, many credits to his name. Together, the two of them have worked on A Doll's House Part 2, Glass Menagerie, Seminar, and We Live Here. I believe that's most of the list.
Yeah.
So, Sam, welcome. David, welcome. It's so great to have you at the table.
Thank you.
And our conversation this evening, we've entitled Breaking Down Ableism, Casting Diversity and Disability. So a lot of our audience is mid-career, early-career directors who may not have had the benefit of having a casting director or working with a casting director in the past. So just as a moment of information, David, could you share with us what is the job of a casting director? What is the artistry that you sort of bring to the process with sort of these larger scale, larger scope producers and productions?
I would say, the role of the casting director, practically speaking, is the producer is usually the ones that hire us. A director may have asked for a casting director they've worked with before or not. We are sent the script, oftentimes in a commercial production there may be a star that's already attached to it. So the director says, we're going to do this play, Denzel Washington wants to do Fences, it's done, will you cast the rest? So I will read the script, if there's already a director attached, maybe have a conversation about the rest of the characters, come up with a list to start off with of say 15 to 25, some directors, maybe that will be 40 names of people that we might want to consider. Mm-hmm. If there isn't a director, it's just me sort of going by my own ideas. And then in collaboration with the director and the writer, if the writer is living, and there's pros and cons to living and dead, whittling that list down, talking about the characters, talking about prototypes, putting in people that we all have in common. And the other way that it can happen is a producer, either at a not-for-profit or for-profit, will say, here's a script. It will only get produced on Broadway if we have a star. So the first part of your job is try to attach a star to it. And we've both been down this road so many times, right? So you get a script where there is a 55 to 65-year-old woman who is the lead. You guys throw out some names of people that you think might be on that list immediately.
Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep. Of course. She's number one, right? And then the next 10. Probably the least interesting part of my job is coming up with star lists because there's a finite number, right? And then it's really about facilitating conversations, I think. It's really just, you know, it's trying to get into the director's wavelength, trying to understand what they wanted, what they're looking for, the kind of people that they're looking for to tell the story, the playwright as well, you know. And then sometimes the director and the playwright maybe are not simpatico, so part of your job is to sort of sit back and watch what that relationship is and figure out the communication there and see where you might facilitate, step back, and sort of be cohesive if you can be. I think the misnomer is the casting directors choose the actors. At the end of the day, we can advise, we can give our opinions. It's not ultimately our decision. It's our decision to bring in. If I've got 15 slots, there's 8 actors that I may choose to bring in that Jim Carnahan may not choose to bring in. That's sort of where the differences are, you know, and there may be a producer that wants to hire Jim and not me based on our work. They think Jim's going to be writer for that than me.
So there's an aesthetic at play. So
sure.
Your relationship with Sam, for example, and we'll get to Glass Menagerie, but let's say We Live Here or Seminar. Like, what were those conversations between the two of you like?
Well, I'd say that you described your job more practically and less sort of romantically than I would have, because for me the this collaboration and relationship is about interpreting character. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have a text, and the most important thing you'll do as a director with that text is decide who's going to perform the text. And so I work with Dave to think about what is the right way to interpret the text through casting. So we have conversations about what kind of person we're looking for, or we go through lists of specific names and think what they would bring or what they might not bring. And where Dave's expertise comes in is that he's seen a lot more than me and knows the community a lot better than me. So if I say, hey, I saw this person in one thing and they seem kind of intriguing to me, but do they have this range to do this kind of thing? And Dave will say, oh yeah, well, 7 years ago I cast them in this and they really brought all of that to it. And so you get a real sense of how, because you're taking a huge bet when you're casting, right? I think this relationship is one of the ways that you just make sure that you bet well on the most important decision you're going to make as a director.
That's great. It's very helpful.
I say, regarding Glass Menagerie, I remember sending the list for Tom. You sort of send it off, and then I remember the next day, you and Scott Rudin was the producer of Glass Menagerie. When I put Joe Mantello on the list, I was like, well, this Joe Mantello is known as the director, but he obviously used to be an actor, and still does sometimes. And for me, that was like, well, this totally interests me. I'm totally intrigued by it. It could be, like, they could hate it. But I've worked with Sam enough, and I've worked with Scott Rudin enough, and God knows I've been yelled at by Scott Rudin enough. And I'm like, okay, well, if he doesn't like it, he doesn't like it. I've been down that road before. But then the next day, there was a conversation where Sam was like, that is totally intriguing to me. And so that's when there's sort of like, oh, cool. We just met right there, and that made, you know, it was sort of immediate, you know? So that's one way when you've worked with someone for a while that you can take some chances and be like, hey, they're not going to think they've hopefully hired the wrong guy and be like, what the fuck is this guy thinking?
So how long have the two of you worked together? What was the first project? How long ago was that?
It was like 7 or 8 years ago, probably.
Was Seminar first or We Live Here?
They were back-to-back, but we did stuff. I'm sure we did readings,
like,
and things
and
at Ars Nova and MTC, yeah. Probably going back 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, most theatrical relationships, it's like, starts in that workshop phase, reading
phase.
Yeah,
readings.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So, this question of diversity. How are artists with disabilities sort of placed within the larger diversity conversation that's happening in the field right now, or in the world right now?
One of the reasons why I think this conversation to have with directors is really important is that I'm in a lot of casting rooms where there's real interest, and people are starting to see and feel interested in making sure that that the art we make represents the communities we're making it for. And you start to see a lot of people trying to articulate that, artists and from all sides, thinking about the importance of representation as artists. As I am involved in those conversations, or I see those conversations happening in the community, I feel that the conversation around artists with disabilities is still a hard conversation to have. Not that the other upper underrepresented communities aren't also hard, but that there are some particularities to the challenges that people come up against when thinking about hiring artists with disabilities. And I think it's important that we sort of demystify those challenges so that we can better represent the communities that we're trying to serve as artists.
What are some of those challenges that are put up as barriers, that perceived or real? What is it that you find producers or even your colleagues out in the field? Is there a resistance?
Yeah, and I mean, it goes down a whole lot of very complicated avenues you can break it down to. You can break it down to an aesthetic conversation about differences between characters and what you notice about the actors playing them. This is an aesthetic conversation you always have as a director. Every time you cast an actor, that actor is different from the character. There is no casting authentically, right? That conversation about interpretation of character through casting is one that I think audiences have been trained to make certain leaps and not make other leaps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, since basically Joe Papp started doing Shakespeare in the Park, we feel quite comfortable seeing the King of England with an actor of color in a Shakespeare play. That the difference between the color of the skin of the actor and the history of that historical figure has not really challenged audiences for 30 years, though it still challenges audiences in many other ways. That as soon as you get one foot away from Shakespeare in the Park, it still challenges people. But we're not here to talk about that. And so when you start talking about disability, the ability of producers, audiences, artists, you know, institutions to see those differences as greater, lesser, equal is a more complicated conversation when it comes to disability.
Mm-hmm. And that's the key word, I think, is conversation. That is the thing, that is the one thing that we have control over in some ways, is moving this forward so that there is a conversation. And we talked about this in the room before we came out here. Did I interrupt you?
No, you go ahead.
Two things about that. One, regarding just diversity. Sam and I did A Doll's House Part 2, right? So it's Condola Rashad, Chris Cooper, Laurie Metcalf, and Jane Howdy Shell. Not to get into reviews, but if you read some of the commentary or whatever, people sort of didn't talk about the fact necessarily or question the fact that Condola was of color. The ones that would pointed to, well, but there was Kleenex, there was a contemporary water bottle, and there was a neon sign. So clearly the world of the play was not such that we were meant to view it. I don't even know what your intention was, but much of what I read about it was, we don't have to talk about the fact that she has two white parents because it's not real. It's not, the rules are not such as we usually expect them, right? So the name of the game here, in some ways, in that regard, I think, is to get to a world where there's a production of Proof. where Sandra Oh plays the older sister, Condola Rashad plays the younger sister. Who the hell knows? Jimmy Smits plays the dad, and who knows whoever else. And there's not a picture on the wall that shows how this genetic thing could have happened, that explains it, right? That we're trying to accept the fact that maybe for the first 5 minutes, the people in the audience are going to be looking around trying to figure out for clues, what are we meant to make of this? In a way that if you walk down the street in New York and people walk past you, you're not doing the math.
Sure.
So we're trying to move it, I think, in some ways from the 5 to 10 minutes of resistance in the audience.
But just to... I'm sorry, now I'm going to interrupt you.
No, please.
But just to get real on the question of disability, because I just want to push at like some ugly truths about the community, is that I think that the challenges are a lot greater than, like, can Jimmy Smits genetically have Condola Rashad as a child. I think it gets into some issues of specific kinds of prejudice that I think it's important for artists to be taking on and interested in confronting. If we're not asking people to look at their ways of thinking and seeing, then what are we doing as artists? And so, for example, in The Glass Menagerie, one of the examples that I keep coming back to in these forums, so if I know there's a couple of people that were here last time, that were in the room last time I told this story, but the one of the reactions to The Glass Menagerie that I'll sort of never forget for its ability to make me depressed was a large number of people having a problem with a line in the play where Amanda says to Laura, what have you been doing when you said you were going to business college? And she says, I've been going out walking. And Amanda says, walking in your light coat in the dead of winter and you're sick. And a lot of people had a really hard time matching a Tennessee Williams line about walking with an actor who uses a wheelchair. And just to break that down on a few levels, I don't know what other fucking word that person is supposed to use, and why. I mean, I basically believe that the people who have that criticism don't want a person who uses a wheelchair to get to use the word walk because they feel they own that word, and they don't want someone who uses a wheelchair to get to have that word, and so it has to do with prejudice, and it makes no sense logically. But even if it made sense logically, even if there was the term wheeled was one that the disabled community had really embraced, and therefore it was cognitive dissonance to hear this person say walked, it's play, and we make those leaps every single second of every single play we go to. And in The Glass Menagerie, there's a character who's a great deal of time is spent talking about how he's Irish. Jim is Irish on both sides, and he has freckles. And Laura, late in the play, gives him the nickname Freckles. Hey, Freckles. And she calls him Freckles because he's Irish and he has a lot of freckles. The actor who I cast did not have freckles and was not Irish. And I never had a single conversation with anyone about... No producer said, hey, when does the makeup artist come with the freckles? Because no one will be able to come see The Glass Menagerie and hear the character say freckles but not see them. How could you? It's too much cognitive dissonance. So why is there no cognitive dissonance about the freckles, but a lot of cognitive dissonance about the wheelchair? That, to me, has to do with an artistic conversation about aesthetic conventions in the theater that link to a conversation about well, about prejudice in the greater culture that feeds those conventions we have mm-hmm. as audience members to art. And so the reason why I want to come and speak to you guys is that I think it's important that as directors that we don't take the conventions for granted. We are the owners of our aesthetic, and we get to tell the audience the rules of the game. And if we start telling the audience the rules are, wheelchairs are like freckles. They don't have to be there. They can be there. Use your fucking imagination, people, to play. Then I think we get to rewrite those rules towards a world where people are represented in a more accurate way in the artistic community. And I'm finding that that's an important conversation to be having, and that in the disability community especially.
And I think, if I can just add to that, do you all know what breakdowns are? Casting directors release breakdowns to the agents. Through our work with Christine Bruno, who is with a group called Inclusion in the Arts, and David Harrell, her partner in that, we realized as casting directors, probably 2 years ago when this conversation started to happen, 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago, that the phrase actively seeking actors of all ethnicities, but it did not include the phrase and of all abilities, actors with
or with disabilities.
Yeah, it wasn't mentioned. That needs to be mentioned. That needs to just be part of this, right? So again, it's sort of changing the language, and it's us, it's casting directors, sending a signal to agencies who do not represent actors with disabilities that, you know what? Represent them. There's a market there, right? And it's only going to get bigger. So let's get them where we can get them, which is the commerce, right? So it's really about us saying, we want to be as inclusive as possible. And then just one last thing, and I'm sorry, speaking to also what Sam was saying, it feels like this community has felt invisible mm-hmm. for a long, long time. And there are reparations that I feel as a casting director, and I think other casting directors feel, need to be made in a way to further offer access to opportunity to actors in this community. What happens once that actor is in the room happens to every actor that goes into the room. They are subject then to the process, the alchemy of the process. What I do not want to have happen anymore is to have this idea of inclusion be a conversation that starts before an actual actor with a disability or something walks into the room, and where we're talking about an actual actor and the talent level of the actor and how right they are for the role, right? If something, whatever then happens, that's the casting conversation. Right. But it's too easy to say at the beginning no. And it's incumbent upon, I believe, you as young artists, wherever you are in your careers, no one's going to push you to do this. We were talking about this too. No one, there's no mandate. Producers are not going to say, hey, you know, how many actors from the PWD community have you seen? You
need we'll to see. Probably push you, the other way. So.
Right.
Definitively will push
right.
the other way.
Yeah. Well, what's that going to mean to my cost? How much is it going to cost to have a sign language interpreter if you bring in a deaf actor or a hearing impaired actor? You know what? How much did it cost you to make that fucking cape for that dude that doesn't need to wear a cape? Then forsake the fucking cape and hire the interpreter for the auditions.
Yeah.
That is now, that's a pre-existing cost. It pisses me off. And that is where I feel like, again, it's incumbent upon you as you start up. This is the way you want to work. This is the...
Yeah, as soon as it becomes just the way it is, those costs are no longer costs anymore.
Exactly right.
It's
an accompanist.
It's just what happens. And I also, I want to demystify this, the cost conversation a little bit, because I've had a number of these kinds of conversations, and one of the questions I get asked a lot is, you know, what are the challenges to opening up the casting pool? And I also want to talk directing pool, designer pool. You know, I'm interested in talking about artists, not actors, but actors tends to be the place where you start because there's more visibility and it's an easier conversation to have. But anyway, when you're talking about artists with disabilities, you get into a conversation about, oh, well, there's challenges, practical challenges associated. And I just want to say, for the record, in my experience, there aren't. It's not hard. That basically, artists living with disabilities have been living in a world that's fucking hard forever. And so is the audition room, is the rehearsal room, is the stage so challenging that those challenges can't be overcome for that artist? Never. Like, no. I'm sorry. It's not a problem. If you want to work with an artist with a disability, you can. So don't blame it on the fact that there are monetary concerns associated with it. There really just aren't.
That's great. Yeah, you know, there's always a way around it.
It's not that hard. It just isn't that hard. I keep having this conversation like, can we all just sit down and really like go through all of, Sam, what have the challenges been? What have been, you know, did you have to make the stage door of the Belasco Theater accessible? Yeah. You know how hard that was? Like, people do this every day. There's something called the ADA. There are a lot of resources and rules and thoughts, and people know how to make a space accessible. You don't have to, it's not like, people in the theater do very challenging, imaginative, creative things. They bust their asses all the time to spend almost no money to make magic happen. Why is getting a wheelchair on the stage hard? You know, so I think it's important that that part of the conversation gets demystified. Yes, a sign language interpreter needs to be paid, and that is money. But exactly, that there are lots of things that cost money.
You make accommodation for
it. And you just, it just becomes part of the cost of doing business. It's not, the challenge to seeing this community more represented is not financial.
Oh, that's a great... great segue. So you all mentioned Alliance for Inclusion in the Arts, which is a fantastic resource. If you're not familiar with it, look it up. Christine is here. We're so pleased to have her representing the Alliance. And there was one of your frequently asked questions, I think, encapsulates this so well. Is why is full inclusion in the arts important? When artists are denied equitable professional opportunities, their exclusion represents a serious loss to the cultural life of the nation. Exclusion further denies artists and audiences alike the artistic benefits of diversity and denies the public an accurate reflection of American society. So if that's not a reason to put resources into these relatively simple fixes, right, so that we can see more of our countrymen, you know, represented, and they can see themselves represented on stage. You know, what are we doing all of this for? So,
but also, there's just really talented artists that we, for totally stupid reasons, aren't getting to know.
So, do you come up against that in casting conversations or in pitch conversations with producers or maybe living playwrights that you're working with? You know, the authenticity question is one question, but. But that the pool of actors is not deep enough. They don't have the training or the experience. I've never seen anyone in a wheelchair on Broadway. You know, do those sorts of resistances come up in your conversations? Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. That's probably the biggest thing, the biggest excuse that someone has is, there's not enough of a community to find great artists from. But it's just an excuse people use because they're lazy or prejudiced.
So what do you do about it though? Like how have you all sort of addressed that when you
outreach first off.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I met a lot of actors through the Glass Menagerie process that I've called in for other roles that did not call for it being a person with a mobility, disability, or anything, just because I thought they were nice actresses. And it shouldn't be that it takes a project like The Glass Menagerie for me to find them, but as we have discussed, because they're not represented. So I don't want this to sound like a honking the CSA horn, but CSA has begun an initiative where every year we are going to be holding open calls for actors in the PWD community every year, filming them, having them on a chip, material of their own choosing that we will then put on the CSA website for CSA members only to go to, right, to see who's out there.
And you have one of these events coming up?
Yeah, we have one. We have one on Sunday, January 7th. It's almost full. We're trying to push for another room. If you go to the CSA website, like, immediately.
It is full. I mean, the one day is full.
So the one day is...
on the second day already, right?
Yeah, but we're trying to add more. I'm not sure where they are in that. Mm-hmm. But if there's more, we're going to accommodate. We're going to make it bigger. So it is educate, you know, the goal is that I should just be bringing in the talented actors. And again, letting someone have the, letting, I mean, I don't know how you feel about this, Sam. What I find, you work with a lot of new playwrights, and I think I find a lot of resistance with new plays, where, and this goes for diversity in general, when a playwright might say, I didn't see the character this way. I don't know that my play speaks to the questions that casting this actor might raise, right? Of course, my answer is there's always reasons to say no. Let's actually try to flip the conversation and say, what could this bring, first off, right? But it's different doing a revival of Proof, right? Where, just say, Catherine is in a wheelchair for the first production. If David Auburn didn't intend for Catherine to be in a wheelchair, David may have questions about what, does my play speak to that, right? And I don't know if you've come across that at all with new playwrights, with new plays, and it's easier for revivals where you've got more license.
It comes back to this conversation I was having about aesthetic conventions. So our aesthetic convention in America on a new play is that a new play needs to be treated with early 21st century American realism as its aesthetic. So we have a bunch of aesthetic concerns. Some playwrights feel really strongly about that. Some are interested in a different conversation. But that's about that playwright wanting to fit their play into the aesthetic conversation
right.
That's conventional right now. If you were in Berlin, the playwright wouldn't feel that way. The playwright has a totally different set of aesthetic concerns in Berlin than they do in New York. So the question of whether you could cast someone that wasn't who the playwright was picturing when they wrote it would be quite different in Berlin than it is here. But what it comes down to for me is that if the pool of artists isn't going to grow if the directors aren't interested in those collaborations. So that is the self-fulfilling prophecy that you have to try to frustrate. If there's no way for an artist with a disability to be seen for this role, then that is going to limit the pool of those artists that are continually going out for that role. As soon as the director says, well, that is no longer the limitations of how we see this role, then that pool starts to grow.
And that pool gets better at auditioning, which is a learned skill. You need to do it to get better at it. And Sam meets that actor on this show, doesn't cast that actor, but knows that actor now. So the next job, it pays forward.
And I think when you go back to this playwriting thing, you know, if the playwrights were going to see plays and seeing actors in all sorts of roles, then when they go to write the play, they'd be like, ooh, you know, I think Christine would be so great to write for, and that would change the writing process. It's all based on the conventions of the community. So as the community grows, then then it fills the community, fills the need that the artists create. We have the power and the control because we're making the work. And writers, we're at a directing in a room filled with directors, but there's a writing question to have too. And so this, it breaks down, and you know, yes, there are new plays by writers who can specify how they see the parts. There are new plays where they specify the parts and then the director suggests a different thing than what the writer thought when they wrote it. And then there are existing plays that conversation isn't the primary conversation and you get reinterpretation. And so there's multiple areas for these kinds of conversations and investigations.
And can I say one more thing? Mm-hmm. I want to have the conversation. I want to have the conversation where I bring an actor, an actress in with a mobility disability, and I want to have the conversation. I want Dave Auburn, I'm using Dave, he wouldn't mind. Mm-hmm. I want someone to say, well, does the fact that she has a mobility disability fuck with the storytelling that she gave up her math career to take care of her dad? Was her disability part of that? Mm-hmm. You know what? Let's have that conversation. That's part of the casting process. Fine, let's have that conversation.
But you have that with everyone.
You have that with
whoever cast.
There's a question, is she attractive enough? Do you really think that guy would want to be... There's
she,
so many...
She has such sad eyes, can she?
Right, play? It's like, you know what? Exactly, right. Let that be one of the questions. And that, I think, is where you as directors can truly and practically affect change. You know, you can really advocate and say, I want to see the widest variety of actors for this role as I can. I want to explore everything that I can, right? Let's have the conversation. If it doesn't go that actor's way, it doesn't go that actor's way. And there's 10 other actors who it may not go their way, right?
So this question of authenticity, I think it's come up, especially it came up often in sort of a lot of the press and the reaction to Glass Menagerie. But what are your feelings about casting characters with disabilities only with actors? Is that the new Othello? Like, we would never cast a white Othello in 21st century America unless it was very high concept, right? And then second half of that question is casting actors and artists with disabilities where the role does not necessarily call for it, where it's their ability is not mentioned.
I don't know why you would not cast an actor, a role of a character who has a disability with an actor who has a disability. I don't know why you wouldn't at this stage in the game. Maybe that's simplistic, but I just don't know why you would not.
Well, what I would say is that we have, until it's a community that's not underrepresented, we have an obligation to seek representation. So I'm not totally interested, right, even though the two obvious plays that I directed where I cast actors with disabilities were plays where that was a featured aspect of the storytelling, I'm not too excited about the conversation about authenticity, because it goes back again to the aesthetic idea I have, which is that there is no such thing as authenticity. So I find that argument specious. The more important argument to me is that we have an obligation to underrepresented communities. If the audience can't handle that underrepresented community in any other role except one in which the storytelling helps justify it, then start there until you don't have to be there anymore. Mm-hmm. And then maybe 20 years from now, it won't be a problem to, like, we won't have to
make
that some kind of political statement about Crip Face and make a thing out of it. That's a thing one does to try to say, well, at least fucking these roles, if you can't give us these roles, then what? And I think we have to, it's just a place to start, and it's an easy place for unimaginative people like myself. I was unimaginative when I said, oh, they call Laura crippled. I guess it's weird that I've never seen an actor with a disability in that role. That's not a very imaginative piece of directing. It's the most obvious play you could ever do with an actor with a mobility disability.
Well, we've all done it.
I was not groundbreaking in my decision, and yet it was still groundbreaking to many people.
Can you guys describe that casting process? I mean, because I mean, I think that's very recent, right?
Yeah.
The casting process from soup to nuts? Like
it, this is
from concept to
the
bring you in.
The concept was this: I was asked to direct the Glass Menagerie with a company of actors in Amsterdam. That company has no actors with disabilities in it, and I was only allowed to cast from within the company. I hadn't thought about the Glass Menagerie in a long time. It wasn't really a play on my radar, and I reread it when I was offered it and had a heartbreaking connection to the play that I hadn't had before. And felt compelled to do the play with this company, even though I wasn't being given the opportunity to work with an actor with a disability. But I did that play, I learned a lot about the play, and I left that process being like, I really want to direct this play, but it's crazy to do this play with with some girl pretending to limp around. It's not aesthetically interesting to me. And so when I left Amsterdam, I had the hunger to work on the play some more. And I knew that if I was going to work on it again, I would like to collaborate with an artist with a disability on how that artist sees Laura. And that I would build a production of the play around that collaboration. So then, to really give you guys the insights to the Frank Ways Broadway plays get on, a producer called me and said, Sally Field wants to do a play on Broadway. She loves your work. What do you have for her? And I said, she can do the Glass Menagerie if I can cast a Laura with a disability. And then we were on. Everybody was totally on board the idea. It was very clear from moment one that there would be no production of this play with me directing it if Laura was not cast within this community. Though Dave heard some conversations about how to try to avoid the crazy director's feelings. And many stars' names were brought up when I wasn't paying attention. We're never going to find this actor, so I've got Carey Mulligan in the wings, you know? And that was the game from the beginning, so it was super clear. So we had Sally, and we started the process to look for Laura, and Dave can talk a bit about how that process cast, you know, for outreach and casting went. But in the end, what it meant was we held auditions, and I got to know some actors and how they related to that part. I think it's a part that a lot of people in that community just hates. And that was part of what I wanted to explore. And I met a couple of actors that I really saw a collaboration with that I could really imagine having telling that story in a certain way. I brought those actors in to work with Sally. And I sort of saw how that mother-daughter relationship would work. And at the end of those auditions, where I read some people with Sally, we offered the part to Madison. And then very little was complicated after that. It was just a play.
Madison Ferris, I'm sure you all
played
know her.
Laura. So, mm-hmm. And you can talk a little bit about when I said to Dave, you know, we had long conversations like, what exactly are you looking for? And I said, I just want to see people from this community. I don't care, like, can it be an actor who uses a wheelchair? Can it be, you know, there's a lot of like, can it be's. And I just said yes to all the canopies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes. I just want to meet people from this community. I don't care. I don't need to parse it any more than I would like when that when the word crippled is used in that play. I'd like the actor I cast to come as an artist to the conversation with a different perspective than mine. That was what I was interested in. I was interested in artists collaborating and having multiple perspectives. That's why we want the community to be inclusive, so that you're working with people with a different perspective than you. And that's all I cared about. That was really the whole thing. I would like to be able to have a conversation with an artist who has a different perspective on this and who's willing to have point of view, you know, which is, there are some actors that want to just be told, you know, where to stand, and they want to do their, they want to do their shtick, and there's some that want to engage with you on that storytelling level, and I was looking for an actor who wanted to be in it with me, who wanted to kind of wrestle with this play that is a beautiful, beautiful play written by someone not particularly interested in physical disability. So what does it mean to explore the play post-ADA? And that's how the conversation went.
Yeah. And honestly, it was a regular casting process in some ways. There was a lot of outreach, you know? I mean, we reached out to...
We saw people from all over the...
Madison was
England.
In Australia when she taped.
It was everyone in the English-speaking world...
Yeah,
you know.
Pretty much London, you know, London, San Francisco, we hired casting directors across the country.
Okay.
Because again, there
so
was
you
like
did
one...
expand your pool.
Oh, absolutely.
Your network.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, I've done other searches, so it was
sure.
a search, you know, but it was the same thing.
Same thing you do all every day.
Yeah, taping, it, you know, it was fascinating, sounds like the wrong word to use, but it illuminated so much for me, and Christina and I have talked about this, I would sit behind the table. Part of a casting director's job is try to understand how best to advocate for any given actor that's in front of you. And you want to adapt to every actor, regardless. And I had to learn, you know, when I would want to stand up and open the door for somebody, dude, this person got to fucking Midtown on the 8th floor on the subway. She's fine. I don't have to get up. And for someone that needed help with the door, can you open the door for me? Those teeny things.
This brings up a really important part of the conversation, which is one of the really big obstacles for artists in terms of if you are a director who does not have history, cultural history, like friends in the disability community, There is a lot of fear about saying the wrong thing, offending somebody, not understanding how to interact with that community.
We have to own it.
And first of all, I think that one thing that you should realize is that if you're living through the fear of your own prejudice, you have to remember that that artist who's coming in to audition for you or whatever, you're one of a million people who says the wrong thing to that person every day. So you have to just get through that. And I think, honestly, for this room, for a room full of directors that want to be here, like have an open mind enough that want to be in this room, there's many conversations that are more important in other rooms, but in this room, I think that's probably the most important part of the conversation for you guys. It is that... You have to use the resources available to you to educate yourselves about the community and get yourself to a place where you're comfortable interacting with that community. That's on you.
Absolutely.
You just have to do that. It's important. You can't let that be an obstacle to working with that community or none of the things that we're talking about happening.
What became fast?
And it does. It happens to all of us. And you do. You make mistakes, as you do with all people. Everybody says the wrong thing to somebody all the time. So it happens.
Yeah, and part of it, honestly, is now going back to other casting directors that have not had a similar experience in casting the way that I did, and having seminars amongst ourselves to sort of say, okay, we want to, again, afford access to this community, and reparations need to be made, and let's do this. And some of the most amazing things for me I can just remember was seeing these women, how many different women used, because it was what they had at their disposal, whatever their physical situation was, Amanda was still Amanda coming at them. So someone in a motorized wheelchair motorizing away was fascinating to me, as was someone who had, you know, arm braces, who didn't have the same ability to just press the button and move, and needed to move. And it was a whole different way of storytelling for me that I just found fascinating. And again, it was one of those things that was like, this is what happens when you say yes. What can this bring, right? And I don't know if you remember this moment with Madison when she was reading, we had an actor read Jim also in her audition. And you and I had talked about beforehand in the gym, you guys know the Jim and Laura scene, he says, sit down. And you had said, I'm not quite sure how we're going to deal with that. We'll figure that out as we go, you know, how she sits. And Madison came in and she said, if it's okay with everybody, I want to get out of my chair. And remember you saying, of course, you know, do what you're comfortable with. And she said, just so you know, it's not going to be pretty. How I get out of the chair is how I get out of the chair. And her physicality was her physicality. And she owned it. She owned the moment. She educated us. And got on the floor with Jim in a way that was incredibly moving and actual, right? And it was...
She made a choice like every good actor makes a
exactly
choice.
Right.
You prepare for an audition.
Exactly
so
right.
So you prepare for the audition and you make choices. Every actor does that. And they come in and they say, hey, I'm going to change sweaters between side one and side two. You know, people just make these decisions. So Madison came in really prepared because she's a really prepared actor. And so she did a really good job and got the part.
ultimately, you would hope for the fact that the actress wouldn't have to feel that she has to take care of us behind the table by saying, I'm going to prepare you for how I am going to look.
Except
how this might make you feel.
Right.
And I understand where it came from, but that's what we don't want.
Right. Try to change that.
We want to meet you where you are.
Right. I want to open it up to the audience. If there are any questions here, we have a few more minutes. Questions for Sam or for Dave. And also, we are streaming live, and there's about a 30-second lag. So if you are streaming and you want to text us a question, we will present it if it gets in that 30-second lag. Anybody here in the audience? Yes?
I have a question that goes back to the casting conversation and what possible barriers you might come up against as a director who wants to make an imaginative casting choice or something that's not written in. I understand if the playwright is living, right? If it's my friend wrote this play and I want to do a self-produced version, I say I want to cast this person, they say no, I say yes, and then you find out if you can compromise. But I had an experience, I produced something when I was still in college, a production of The Last 5 Years, and the director wanted to cast a woman as Jamie, so it's a lesbian couple instead of a heterosexual couple, and the estate said no. And I understand, you know, when, for you guys, in high-profile productions, it might be easy to, like, get them on the phone and say, hey, I really want to do this.
Or in high-profile cases, which there have been quite a few, including the Edward Albee estate, that you basically legally have no leg to stand on in this conversation. It's awful, but the rights to the play belong to the author, and they are able to stop you because that's how copyright works in our country. And the writer wins. And that is really good for lots of reasons. I'm married to a writer, and she really, really likes those laws. But those laws protect, you know, racists like Edward Albee. You know, it's just the way it is.
And you don't stop asking. For how many years has Sondheim not allowed a same-sex company, and now it's going to happen. So it's like, don't stop.
The time, yeah, exactly. Those writers will catch up when we change the conversation. Mm. Once Hamilton did, you know, cast that way, then the next writer who comes along opens up their, you know, that estate says, you know, the gates are open. Go reinvent my work now. Let's go see it, because you know it'll benefit that writer and that estate. So,
and don't think that the Albee estate saying no, you can't have a black Nick, and the uprising around it doesn't then make the Albee estate second guess itself.
Not good press for the Albee
estate. Not good press, and it's gonna pay it forward in ways that now they're going to have to be more open. I can say that.
It's
for a
really it's that is a very push. Fascinating conversation, and you should Google the Albee thing and do some reading, because interesting artists have written on both sides of that argument. There are good, interesting things to say on both sides, and it comes down to, you know, the authorial control versus the importance of representation. And there are arguments on both sides of that, and it's a fascinating conversation. The Albee thing this year really brought some interesting articulations of that. It's worth looking at.
Alex?
I have a question about casting for John and Genevieve. Did you see a lot of blind actors? That was one of those situations.
It was written for Lois, so it was done before I had a part of that conversation.
Okay. Do you have regrets on that, or would you like to see that?
I definitely have regrets about that, and I tried to get. I heard that Judi Dench was going blind, and so I offered her Ham and Endgame to try to engage with that. And she said no, but that I did that because when I was working on John, I was thinking a lot about Ham and Endgame, and I did have a lot of regrets about that, and it made me think, oh, how could I do Endgame with a blind actor, and the theater that I was doing Endgame at needed a star, so I was like, who are the blind stars? And I found Judi Dench.
Is she doing it?
No. She doesn't. I think she can't remember the lines anymore.
That's what she
I
said.
I shouldn't have said that in public.
She did say that though, and in her own article.
Okay, good. I just was like, this is being recorded. Can't say things. Judi Dench. She's my favorite.
We've got time for a couple more. Were there any online questions that came through? No.
They're very happy.
Well, they're very happy.
I'm interested, Sam, in what you said when you said that Laura is a part that a lot of the actors in the disability community hate.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that in auditions, and does it make you question whether it's a worthwhile pursuit to do this play and to cast it in this way? And what's our responsibility there in terms of the community feel, or a lot of folks in the community?
Well,
it's not worthwhile.
If I didn't think it was worthwhile, I wouldn't have done it. I mean, I did it because I thought that there was a lot in there to unpack, and I would like to think that my production of that play was an exploration of some of the things that are complicated to unpack about that play and its relationship to disability. So I thought it was really worth a conversation, and that theater doesn't have to be tidy. You can put things on stage that make people upset. That just because that part of Laura makes some people in the disability community upset doesn't mean that play should be banned. It means that when we do that play, or if we do that play, our point of view on that play should include that perspective, and we should move forward from there. And I didn't really know what I wanted to say until I cast Madison, and then we said it together. It was a conversation between the two of us. And speaking to your question about how did I deal with that in the room, knowing some people might hate that part, is I tried in auditions to have an open, collaborative conversation with the actors, which is what I do as a director. That's just who I am as a director. I like working with actors that are interested in storytelling. So I like sharing my vision as a director and looking for collaborators that wanna challenge or get involved in that conversation. So not just in the Glass Menagerie, but in everything I do, I'm looking to do that. And so I think I came into those auditions with a lot to articulate and a lot for the actors to respond to. And I gave them the opportunity to have mixed feelings about Laura and to say, would it be of interest to you to see this character in this kind of way? Hey, what if? And start these kind of what ifs that make the character. Chris, maybe you remember something about it.
I do. I was just going to say, and you did it too, David. So you must have had a conversation before you even held your initial auditions. Because I think one of the reasons a lot of us don't like the character is because of the assumptions that are put on her. This character is this. That she's a wallflower. She's a this. She's a human being.
Right?
So I played the role a few years ago, and I waited like 10 years. Because if you're going to do this work professionally, if you are a woman of a certain age with a mobility disability, every single person is going to say, you know what, who you should play? You should play Laura. Even if you as a human being have no relationship to that character, just because of your physicality, someone's going to say that. So when I met with Sam, Sam said you were very clear about the sort of take that you were looking, he was looking for Laura to be a strong, empowered, person.
Yeah, what would happen if a person with agency was described as a person who, you know, has self-confidence problems? What if that isn't actually how Laura feels about herself, it's just how people characterize her, and what if they characterize her that way based on assumptions they make based on looking at her and not knowing her? And how does that start to create some storytelling about that family? What's that family like? What happens when your brother treats you this way and your mother treats you this way and you don't see yourself the way they see you, and so you spend a lot of time at the zoo?
What do you choose to give currency to as an actor reading the script, right? What's your text analysis?
Sure.
Yeah, she takes her lunch money and goes to fucking art museums.
Goes to the movies. And,
right? Like,
she's, you know,
she finds
put,
her bliss. She just gets told her bliss is not bliss.
And if it wasn't for Amanda, and if she was born into a different family, would she have had a different kind of life where those weren't the words used to describe her? It's not, you don't have to assume that what the... they tell you that in acting class, right? Write down all the words everybody else says about you, and then that's how you should play. There's also the opportunity to write down all the words everybody says about you and then say, fuck all those people. And I chose that approach to Laura.
Also, you can't assume that every actor that comes into audition likes the role they're playing, and that's sort of like, you know what? It's a job. And so sometimes it's about, I want a job, I want insurance.
Right.
I may not like this character, I may not like this play, but I'm going to audition for it. This obviously
yeah,
your
yeah,
question
not,
is about.
I'm not, yeah, I'm not, I don't have a thin skin about, you know, oh, does everybody really like my ideas? You know what I mean? I have a
right.
point of view and a vision, and I'm looking to find its way to the light. So
yeah.
The short answer to your question is I believed in my directorial vision of that play. It wasn't that I was making excuses for it. It wasn't like, I was forced to direct the Glass Menagerie, and I had to find some reason to take this shitty play and do it. I really love the play; it moves me, and I love the play. I think it's heartbreaking and moving. And I also think that it would be fascinating to look at the family dynamics of that play, if you basically took the metaphor. Tennessee Williams is writing the disability in that play is a metaphor for him, and, you know, replaced it with something that wasn't the same metaphor, wasn't a metaphor, and what would happen to the play?
Mm-hmm.
And that was what the production was trying to answer successfully to some, very unsuccessfully to others.
One more?
Yes.
So, David, I'm wondering, like, Sam is very much thinking about these questions and, like, directing towards them.
Mm-hmm.
Are you working with directors who are oblivious? Are you finding yourself trying to push them in this direction? How much do you feel like you're able to move people who are not, like, innately tackling these questions? And what are the responses?
Succinctly.
That's an amazing question, and it's a question of the time, and my honest answer is, I'm in the middle of it.
Yeah.
We're in the middle of it. Ask me the same question in
but
a year.
I would like to try to end on a positive note. I'm trying to talk to directors about this question wherever I can, because I really don't think it's that hard, and so I think, you know, it all makes sense, and once people hear it, they will probably start changing. And, like, my guess is that every director in this room will leave this conversation more interested in working with artists with disabilities than they were previously, if you aren't already extremely devoted to that community or within that community already. And, like, I did another one of these. When was that thing at New York Theater Workshop? In June.
Yeah.
And I held a meeting for, they were basically like just directors in my Rolodex. I just like called up the people who I thought would probably haven't been thinking about this.
It was like 25 of us,
like,
right?
Yeah, it was like, who are the people who are in my community who aren't thinking about this, who once I say it will start thinking about this? I had the meeting. And the week after that meeting, I got a phone call from Rachel Chavkin saying, I'm devoted to casting this play.
Lee Silverman.
And I got a call from Lee Silverman saying, I'm devoted to casting my play. This way, like two plays, in 1 week that totally changed their casting philosophies based on that one conversation. This isn't an enormous community. You have five conversations, you think about it for 5 minutes, and then the whole off-Broadway season is different next year, and then the audience receives that differently, and then it doesn't take that long until the whole community starts shifting. So it really is, this is not brain surgery, and it's not awful.
And it's not a wall of resistance.
It's
not directors saying, I don't want to do this at all.
Some of it is.
Well,
some of them.
I don't know that they will admit that. But what I would say to you is, what you're up against a lot is time. Right? You've got a director who has 3 days to do auditions. They have an idea of how they want to get it done. They've got an idea of how they want to cast it. So it's about expediency. And sometimes thinking outside the box takes time, right? And it's actually, it expands a process that is like this, right? So again, the more it just becomes integrated. We are looking for an integrated talent pool. That's the bottom line, an integrated talent pool. That's all that it is. And I think what Sam is saying, it's not rocket science. It's, here's 10 actors.
Right.
Three happen to be persons with disabilities. Great. And then the more that becomes the norm, then it becomes the norm, right? And I think we're heading in the right direction, to pick up on your optimism, you know. But there's still a lot of noise to be made.
Great. Sam, thank you. David, thank you. And thank you all.
Indeed.
For
coming. Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by SDC Foundation. SDC Foundation events and programs are designed to offer access, opportunity, and community to directors and choreographers at all levels of their career. To find out more, visit our website at www.sdcfoundation.org.